And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Yeah, it's good to be with you today. Greetings. Hello, everybody. Yes, it's time for apologetics. You have entered into the apologetic zone, Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm your host, your sensei, your good friend, Gary Machuda, talking about how to explain, defend the faith with clarity, charity, and with confidence. And we have a great show. One thing I try to do on this program is kind of make it into a group of Catholics who love the church and want to explain and defend it, share it with others, and help all of us kind of sharpen each other's skills in how to explain, defend the faith. And part of being an apologist is, for those watching on live stream, you notice there's a bunch of books behind me. This is actually a small section of my home library. Is books. Books are our tools, our weapons. Books help inform us so that we can learn from experts, we can learn from those who have gone before us, and those contemporary authors today who can impart wisdom and help us sharpen our intellects, learn more about Christ and his church, about church history, things like that. But where do you start? Which books do you absolutely need if you're going to be explaining, defending the faith? Well, guess what? Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to have the guy who started off the modern Catholic apologetics movement in America. Carl Keating is coming into the dojo, and we're going to continue our series. We're doing a once a month. Carl's coming on board, and we're going to talk about the books that absolutely every Catholic apologist ought to have on their bookshelf. And so today's book is actually I have my copy right here, Theology and Sanity by Frank Sheed. So Carl's going to come on board. We're going to talk about who Frank Sheed was, why this book's important, and why, if you want to defend, explain the faith, why you really should work through that book. It's an awesome, awesome book, by the way. And as always, we are going to do our critical thinking skills, sharpen our critical thinking skills by addressing an informal fallacy. Today's fallacy for finding the fallacy is the argumentum ad baculum, otherwise known as the argument from the stick. How do you like that one? And and also we meet the early church fathers. Today's church father is a relatively unknown person. Nevertheless, he is part of the ranks of the corpus, which we call the early church fathers. His name is Celestius. So we're going to talk a little bit about Celestius. And of course, you are part of the program, especially when Carl comes on board. Give us a call. 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. We'd love to hear from you. And, maybe you have questions about for Carl, especially on, material that you could acquire to help you become a better defender of the faith, a more faithful disciple of Jesus Christ. And in case you can't get to the phone, but nevertheless have questions or comments, you can always send an email to us at the dojo mailbox, which is questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's questions@handsonapologetics.com. Love to hear from you. Your email flies through the internet directly into the dojo mailbox, which I try to promptly answer every email that comes through there. And occasionally I will hold people some of the letters for the show. We'll talk about on the show. We've had awesome letters in the past. And now it's time for our shout-outs to those watching live stream on social media, on Facebook and YouTube. Hi, everybody. Ah, yes, love the emojis. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'll watch it. Okay. Just reading some of the questions, but that's not fair to you because not everybody's watching on social media. We also have, thank you for listening to the program live on the air, and those listening on podcast. And as always, I always try to point people to this. Books are an awesome resource for apologists for explaining, defending the faith. There are tools. You don't have to know everything, but you have to really know where to get the things you need. So books are an awesome resource to have handy in case you need to research something. But, you know, there's also multimedia stuff. There's there's YouTube channels. You know, there's a Hands-On Apologetics YouTube channel. You can consult all the awesome guests that we've had on the show, along with all the other great programs on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And also their podcasts can be found on the Mothership website, which is virginmostpowerfulradio.org, all one word, virginmostpowerfulradio.org. And you can access not only this program, but all the other awesome programs that Virgin Most Powerful points out. And, hey, Charles, how you doing? I turned to the live feed and just happened to see somebody saying, "Hey, Gary." "Hey, Charlie, how you doing?" Okay, so without further ado, why don't we jump to the finding of the fallacy. Finding the fallacy for today is the fancy Latin name, argumentum ad baculum, also known as the argument from the stick or to the stick. Basically, it's committed, and I got this off Wikipedia, so we could talk a little bit about it. By the way, Wikipedia is a great resource, but it also, you got to be careful. I found lots of wrong things on Wikipedia. But anyway, it's committed when someone appeals to force or the threat of force to bring about the acceptance of a conclusion. One participates in argument ad baculum when one points out the negative consequences of holding the contrary position. Okay, so, so basically it's a threat, right? It's, just reminding the person about all the unfavorable things that would happen if they decide to take a particular point of view or a particular path. You know, I don't like that last line, so let's criticize Wikipedia, shall we? One who participates in this, when they point out the negative consequences of holding a contrary position. That could be true, but I don't think it's true in all cases. You could always point out logical inconsistency and error for holding a contrary position. You can also logically argue from, do what's called an argumentum ad absurdum. You could reduce the contrary position to the absurd. That would not be a fallacious way of arguing. That would not be the argument from the stick or argumentum ad baculum. But if you're castigating it and threatening, you know, that if you hold the contrary position, then everybody else is going gang up and beat you up, then that would be the fallacy. So, you know, we'll have to put a little bit of nuanced correction there. But that is our finding the fallacy for today. The argument from the stick, you know, basically threatening somebody if they hold the contrary view. So no need to dive into that. I think that's pretty apparent, you know, self-evident. So let's jump to our Meet the Early Church Father for today, who is Celestius, who lived roughly around AD 429. He is probably of Italian origin, and we meet Celestius in history at Rome about the year 405. He was a disciple of a fellow named Pelagius. Now, we've talked about Pelagius and Pelagianism on this program, not plagiarism, like when you're stealing something, but Pelagianism. And basically that is a heresy where, in a sense, it denies original sin. And so basically we can justify ourselves through our own actions apart from God's grace. So Pelagius kind of argued that we could kind of pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, just by our natural goodness. And God's grace is helpful, but it's not needed. And so so he was a disciple of Pelagius, and later he went to Carthage in 410 and remained there with Pelagius, while Pelagius went to Palestine, excuse me. He was condemned as a heretic in several synods in North Africa in 411 and 412. He went to Ephesus, where he was ordained to the priesthood, then on to Constantinople. The next time we meet him is in 417 and 18, where he's back in Rome, and where he was condemned along with Pelagius by Pope Innocent I, and in the former year of Pope Zosimus in the latter. So basically two popes outrightly condemned him by name along with Pelagius. In 418, following the condemnation of Zosimus, Celestius was obliged by imperial edict to leave Rome and return to Constantinople, and it's probably where he died. Basically, we have no trace of him after the year AD 429, and so we assume that he probably likely died somewhere around thereabouts. As for writings from this fellow, we don't really have anything. The only thing that we have from him are fragments that are preserved in other works. Most specifically, St. Jerome mentions some of his beliefs in his letter 133. So if you want to check out, it's almost like a brief little excursus from Celsius. Check out Jerome letter 133. You can read it for yourself and kind of get a feel for it, where basically he says, I'll give you this, the hands-on apologetic summary of what he says. He says, look, if God's grace is required, then we can't have free will. We have free will, therefore, you know, obviously God's grace is not required. So that's my little interpretive snippet of Celsius. Anyway, so that's our Meet the Early Church Fathers for today. And again, you know, it's kind of cool because we have examined a couple of people from the same period, and all of them more or less are tied to that heresy of plagiarism. And by the way, you know, we should be look out for this heresy. It does kind of sneak in, you know. We can't do good works apart from God's grace, both the desire to do them, it gives us the power to do them, and ultimately he crowns his own work in us when we do good works. All right, coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to be talking with Carl Keating about a book that absolutely every Catholic apologist ought to have on their bookshelf. So stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to talk about a book that every Catholic apologist ought to have read and have on your bookshelf. And to help us work through that book, we have Carl Keating coming on the show. Carl is the founder of Catholic Answers. He worked with that organization, did numerous debates, wrote several books. In fact, now he is basically a full-time author. He's written over 16 books and more on the way, including, of course, I think one of the most important Catholic apologetic works to come out in the last 40 or 50 years, at least, is Catholicism of Fundamentalism. He has a Debating Catholicism series, Book for Life, No Apology, you know, just to name a few. He's a writer of several genres, including religion, literature, outdoors, self-publishing, fiction, all sorts of great stuff. And you can check out Carl's repertoire of books, I guess, at www.carlkeating.com. So, Carl, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Carrie, it's great to be back with you. And today we're talking about a book that is on the top of our list, both of us.
Yeah. That's right, and that is none other than, and those watching on live stream, you can see a picture of it, Theology and Sanity by Frank Sheed.
Yeah. Of all Sheed's books, and I have all of them, they form, you know, shelf and a half, two shelves at home. Yeah. Of all his books, this is my favorite, Theology and Sanity. And as we'll get into it, I'll explain. The only thing I don't like about the book is the title, and I'll explain that shortly.
Okay, yeah. He wrote quite a bit. Actually, you know, before we even talk about the book, I know a lot of people probably aren't familiar with Frank Sheed, even though he's written so much and he's so influential in Catholic apologetics.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about his background.
To his, at least his surname might be familiar to a lot of Catholics, from the publishing company Sheed and Ward,
right,
which for many years was the premier Orthodox Catholic publisher in the English-speaking world. You might say that the analog today would be Ignatius Press, okay, which published many of the same kinds of books. But Sheed and Ward, named for Frank Sheed and his wife, Maisie Ward. Frank was born in Australia, and he moved to England, and he became, in short order, one of the leaders of the Catholic Evidence Guild, which is based in London. Mm-hmm. And was best known for its weekly public speeches in Hyde Park's Speaker's Corner. And there's a rather amusing story about that Sheed tells in his autobiography called The Church and I, about how he ended up meeting Maisie Ward. And he was, at that point, a junior speaker. And he was observing other senior speakers doing their thing outdoors at Hyde Park. And this is a venue where you just talk to the crowds passing by in this big outdoor area. And most of them are not Catholics, and many of them are hecklers. And you've got to be able to deal with the hecklers. And so eventually she got up, and it was his turn to talk about something. And the crowd faded away while he was at the platform. He couldn't keep them. And a woman senior speaker got up, pulled him down, got up and brought the crowd back. Then she got up again, and again the crowd left. So the woman got back up and brought back the crowd. And she said, I was so impressed by that I married her. the woman was Maisie Ward.
Wow.
And she was descended from William George Ward, a very famous 19th century English convert and Catholic, a very prominent man there around the time of Vatican I. So Frank and Maisie founded the Sheed and Ward Publishing Company. He was born, by the way, in 1897. She was some years older than he. I forget when she was born. And it became the most prominent, as I say, English language publisher of solid Catholic books. Few works of fiction, mostly nonfiction, and from the top writers around the world. And, you know, basically Sheed and Ward kept that going through pretty much near the end of their lives. So Frank became, I think, the number one Catholic apologist, possibly in the world, but I'm going to say just English-speaking world, during his lifetime. If there's somebody who is an equal apologist in some other language group, I'm not aware of it. But he wrote lots of books. And I think the top value of Frank Sheen's writing is he's so clear, so sensible, so logical, but he's simple and clear in his writing. He's not simplistic ever, but he's never turgid or confused or sounds too academic. His writing is so practical that it's accessible by everybody who's gotten past about the eighth grade. And some of his writings are, in certain areas, are the best I've ever come across from any Catholic writer regarding certain topics.
Wow. Yeah, that's high praise. Well, you know, his training in Hyde Park undoubtedly allowed him to hone those skills of both holding somebody's attention, you know, being clear, yeah, but also anticipating objections.
Yes, because as I say, the crowd was always filled with hecklers. Yeah. So what the Catholic Evidence Guild did was they actually trained their speakers very assiduously. You had to attend classes regularly, and the classes would be one where you would learn in each class one very narrow topic. For example, the question might be whether it's proper, according to scripture and tradition, to baptize infants or whether you're supposed to only baptize adults. Okay?
Okay.
So that's a very narrow question, but it might take all night or more than one night for the class to go through to understand what the church's teaching is on that, what historical events point to that teaching, and then what complaints there are from whether Protestants or just non-Christians about infant baptism, and then how to deal with those complaints. And so they would have these classes, normally taught by a priest, but not necessarily. And once everybody learned that particular topic well enough, each person would have to get up in front of the class and defend it as though he were standing out of doors in Hyde Park. Oh. And for that, the class would become the hecklers. So they would put on their hats as angry Protestants or what have you, and would be talking over the guy and saying, what about this? What about that? Or don't you Catholics teach? No, giving him a hard time, just like he would get in public, yeah, in real life. And once you go through that kind of training for not one or 10, but 100 topics, then you really know how to deal with them, really under any circumstance. So once you know enough on a particular thing, then you're allowed to be a junior speaker and to go out and talk only on that one topic. If you only know the infant baptism thing, that's all the guild would let you talk on, then they drag you down from the platform. But when you learned enough things, then you became a senior speaker and you could talk on basically anything. And you'd also be overseeing the junior speakers. So it's a very finely arranged system of instruction and practice. So the members of the Catholic Evidence Guild became far and away, I think, the best explicators of the faith in the England or generally Britain at that time. And here I'm talking about the 1920s through the 1940s. Those are the heyday years of the Catholic Evidence Guild. It still technically exists in London. I think maybe in one or two other spots, Canada, in the U.S. even, but only in a token form. The organization really pretty much petered out by the 1970s. But okay, back in those decades, 20s, 30s, 40s particularly, they were drawing large crowds and doing amazing work.
Yeah. Why do you think so? Is it because of the rise of, you know, media, TV, radio?
Mm-hmm. That, yeah, radio and TV. I mean, radio came along really as a popular thing in Britain only in the later 1920s. So if you wanted to get, you know, be listening to some kind of controversial thing, you had to go out in public or, you know, to a theater venue where there might be a lecture. But then, of course, once TV came along in the 1950s, that really was a blow to outdoor public speaking. And then I would suppose if had the guild lasted long enough, you know, then the internet would have, you know, been the third nail in that coffin. So yeah, that kind of public access, although, you know, there are other groups that still do that to emulate some of what the guild did. But the guild came along at an opportune time. And the nice thing about it is not just the work it did for the public that happened to pass by its speaking platforms, but it trained people who later on became good writers and teachers of others. Not just she, but there are many others who went through the guild and worked with him over the years. who themselves wrote books. Cecily Hastings would be one, for example. She wrote several books. Each of them is very well suited for someone who's a bit skeptical about Catholicism or religion in general. Mm-hmm. One of the bywords of the Catholic Evidence Guild was that it didn't skip the hard questions. It didn't try to paper over difficult historical points. Hmm. And there was, sometimes you have to say, back in such and so century, there were some Catholics who did some bad things, or even some, less than adequate popes at some points in history. What about the Inquisition? What about this, that, or the other thing? And the tendency for so many folks is Catholics who don't really know how to explain these things is they avoid them. And then it becomes pretty obvious they're avoiding them. And when you're seen to be avoiding tough questions, the outsider thinks a little less about your position.
Right. Yeah, people can tell when you're trying to tap dance and, change the subject. And, it's usually those real hard questions that are the most important. If you can somehow address it, even if it's just, conceding what you can concede and clarify what you could clarify, that can go a lot longer than things that aren't so contentious.
I think the two most powerful tools a Catholic apologist has is to concede that the problem things, because Catholics during the years occasionally have done some things they shouldn't have done, in the historical public sense. So that's one thing. The second is, when you don't know something, you don't know how to answer something, say so. And say, I'm sure the Catholic faith is right because it's been right on everything else, but I don't know how to answer this one question. Let me look it up and I'll get back to you. That is the most powerful thing you can say to somebody questioning the faith, is to admit you don't know, but you look it up and you get back to that person.
Yes, absolutely. And that gives them permission so that if you say something, they'll have the humility to say, I don't know, but I'll check into it. And so it kind of builds a rapport.
It does, because, a lot of people who are antagonistic to the Catholic faith, whether they're Protestants or people brought up in a secular mindset, they're operating from a position of unknown historical prejudice, family prejudice, what have you. My family's always been free thinking, going back to the 19th century word, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Carl Keating about a book that you need to have on your bookshelf, Frank Sheets, Theology and Sanity. We'll be right back right after this.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. There's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Carol Keating on a book. You know, we're going through a series of books that every Catholic apologist ought to know and have on their bookshelf. We're talking about Frank Sheed's Theology and Sanity, one of the greatest books in apologetics in the English language, as far as I'm concerned. And Carl, you know, at the beginning of the program, you mentioned that you have almost two bookshelves full of Frank Sheed's work, and yet you would single this out as his greatest work. How so?
Mm-hmm. Well, partly, I suppose, there's a personal aspect to it, because in coming across this book, I discovered in a key part of it, the best explication of the Trinity I've ever read.
Yes.
And that's always been an issue that has been a little difficult for apologists to deal with in the public, not with other Christians so much, but people outside the faith. I mean, how to explain what we mean by the Trinity. And so I really appreciated that. And there's much else, of course, in Theology and Sanity. I did mention also at the top of the hour, the only thing I don't like about the book is the title.
That's right. And
here's why. When people look at the title, and they might, especially when they compare it to, I think, Sheed's better-known book with a similar title called Theology for Beginners, that's probably the book of his that most people come across first. And that, by the way, is a very good book, and I recommend it highly.
Yes.
But then they look at Theology and Sanity, and they begin to say, oh, is this about psychology in some way? Because that's what the word sanity implies. And actually, the answer is no. I mean, there are psychological reflections, I suppose, in the book. But what she means is this. All of reality is divided into two parts. I mean, you know, Caesar wrote that all of Gaul is divided into three parts, you know, in the Gallic Wars. So we can say that, in a way, Sheed is taking one up from Julius Caesar and saying, all of reality is divided into two parts, the natural and the supernatural. Now, the second of those are the more important, the two parts. But here below, the first one, the lesser importance, is the one where we're constantly swimming in, and so it's more obvious to our, you know, our minds. But so many people don't see beyond the natural part. To them, that's the whole of reality. And they're leaving out a consideration of the supernatural part of reality. And, you know, consider the physician who disbelieves in the existence of bacteria and viruses. Would we say that he was, as a physician, was really quite sane? No. We'd say there was something wrong with his mental processes, that he'd be, in a way, insane in terms of medical knowledge if he thought that bacteria and viruses didn't even exist. Well, Sheed here is saying there's a kind of insanity if you don't believe or pay attention to the more important half of reality, which is the supernatural. And so for you to be thoroughly sane as a person, you need to have all the components in place, which is an appreciation not just for the world that your senses can perceive, but for also for that bigger world that your mind can perceive but your senses can't. Right. And so that's basically where he's getting the idea of theology and sanity, because theology, in terms of healing a person, in many ways is more important than medicine or psychology, because it gives you a sane understanding of the way things really are. You know, in previous shows, I've mentioned to you my favorite line from Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, his 1891 encyclical, where he says, there's nothing so salutary as to view the world as it really is. And that's what Sheed is showing in Theology and Sanity. And so, as I say, I would have chosen some different title. I don't have something in mind, but that's the only thing I don't like about the book. Otherwise, yeah. I think it's a wonderful book.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, I mean, he's making a really good point with the title, but you're right. It's not something that is self-evident. Oh, this book is obviously about, you know, getting a firm and a true grasp of all reality. You know, it does kind of lend itself to misunderstanding. And, you know, the flip side, too, is insanity is where we think something is when it really isn't. You know, we're not grasping the truth of the thing in itself.
No, yeah. Now, theology of insanity is like Gaul for Caesar. Theology of insanity is divided into three parts.
Okay.
After a little preliminary, the first part is about God. The second part is about creation. And the third part is about oneself. So very logical, sort of Thomistic division, really. Mm-hmm. And under the God part, there are seven fairly short chapters, running about 50 pages total, about who God is, how we can start to understand the notion of infinity. And then he goes on to the Trinity itself. What do we mean by three persons in one nature? What do we mean, Father, Son, and Spirit? What's their relation? Are those arbitrary terms? Are they things that actually tell us something about the Godhead? Or do they just cover up something? You know, one of the things in this book and in other books that Sheed says is that there are a lot of inferior understandings of the Trinity among Christians. Some of us grew up in a time where it seemed like every other pastor of a parish was an Irishman who had, you know, come in from the old country to America. And the Irish priests, of course, were fond in certain years of using the shamrock as a way to talk about the Trinity. Here we got three leaves and one stem, therefore three persons in one nature. And Sheed in this book and elsewhere counsels against those kinds of images. It might be three drops of water becoming one big drop of water, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, none of those things help you understand the Trinity. They only help you swallow the Trinity. Mm. That is, you imagine that you understand it when you talk about the Trinity in terms of three drops of water or the three leaves of a shamrock. But in fact, those things are not helping you, because if you look at the shamrock, what have you got? Three separate things in one stem. So how is that three related persons, but in one nature? Then the three drops of water is even worse, because three drops of water put together to make one big drop, you end up with one big drop. You don't end up with three distinct drops of water anymore.
Right.
You know, so you end up with these kinds of things of saying, oh, okay, yeah, you know, I think I understand things now. Three equals one. And of course, then the non-Christian laughs at you. Three does not equal one. Because if you don't, this is another thing Sheed says, if you don't make it clear that three what equal one what, if you're just dropping out those other things and you get the numbers only, mm-hmm. then you're left with no explanation at all.
Yeah.
So he counsels against flaccid or weak or easy ways to understand the Trinity. And we have to keep in mind that all Christian beliefs, list as many as you wish, the most fundamental of all is the doctrine of the Trinity, because it's about God's own inner nature. It's about God himself.
Yeah.
Everything else follows from that. Everything in creation is secondary. I mean, in essence, even Jesus Christ becoming God-man is secondary in primacy, in importance, logically, to what God himself is and what he's like inside it, what God's interior life is like, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So we need to get the Trinity right. But to do that, we have to get around a lot of lazy thinking. And so she goes on in Theology of Insanity about how people misunderstand what spirit is, for example, mm-hmm. versus matter. And he goes at some length about that to make it clear what's what. He talks about God as spirit and the relations between the three members of the Godhead and what that means and so on. But as I say, his whole discussion, which runs just about 50 pages, is the clearest I've seen, clearer than Thomas Aquinas, clearer than any modern writer that I've come across. And so if nothing else, if this book had to be reduced to just 50 pages, I'd cut out those 50 pages and print it separately and, yeah, and call it, you know, The Modern Man's Best Way to Understand What the Trinity Is. And pass that out, you know, to non-believers, to Unitarians who believe in a unity of God, if they believe in God at all. They don't believe that God's a Trinity. Give it to Muslims who don't believe in the Trinity. You know, give it to complete non-believers. They may end up not accepting the Trinity, but once they read Sheed, they would at least understand what we're talking about.
Yes, yes. I agree. I of all the treatments on the Trinity, Sheed does the best. I think he's on par with Augustine and Athanasius, especially Augustine. But the thing is, on rabbit trails, where Sheed is focused like a laser, you know, nothing extraneous with Sheed. Everything serves the purpose.
Yes, and he's focused on the modern, you know, sensibility, the modern concern, the modern problem. Augustine and, you know, Athanasius, Aquinas, of course, having lived so long ago, they weren't even able to predict the kind of situation we live in, and the mindset people have. And so even though Sheed wrote this book a lifetime ago, his presentation of the Trinity is perfectly useful today. When we see so many people in America, you know, now the reports are that half the people call themselves non-religious, period, you know, belonging to no church, half the people in America. You know, we've never had that proportion before. But even those people coming across Sheed's writing on this, so many of them would have, you know, what I call the V8 experience, from, if you remember the old commercial about the V8, where a guy slaps his forehead and says, oh, I could have had a V8, you know.
Yeah.
You know, why
yeah.
did I see that? And I think that they, people reading Sheed on this, would have that kind of response. Gosh, why didn't I ever realize that? I mean, yes, you know, as abstruse as the mystery of the Trinity is, nevertheless, there's so much about it we can know. And by the way, this may be a good time to talk about mystery.
Oh, well, we only have 30 seconds, so maybe we could do that on the other side.
We'll do it after the break.
Awesome. Well, we're talking with Carl Keating about a book that every Catholic apologist ought to have on his bookshelf, which is Frank Sheed's Theology and Sanity. Working through this, and folks, it definitely is a pickup aisle, along with the writings of Carl Keating himself, so keep that in mind as well. We'll be right back on Hands on Apologetics. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber.
Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Carl Keating about the classic apologetic work, Frank Sheed's Theology and Sanity. And by the way, you know, talk about classic works. You can also access Carl's continuing work and authorship at carlkeating.com. And Carl, before the break, you know, you mentioned mystery. I just wanted to jump in that one of my favorite quotes from this book is where Frank Sheed shares about how he was trying to explain what spirit is. And I'm probably going to butcher this, but, you know, he says that, it's a spirit doesn't have a body. It doesn't, it doesn't apply to space and so on. And he goes through all this, what it's not. And then somebody in the crowd says to him, that's the best explanation of nothing I ever heard. And then it goes on to give a great explanation about what mm-hmm. spirit is. And, you know, mystery is another one of those terms that it could end up being more mysterious if you don't explain it right.
Yeah, you know, nowadays you hear the word mystery, and to many people's mind, you end up thinking of Agatha Christie or, you know, some detective story, and yeah. That's what a mystery is. And but in the religious sense, you know, mystery is actually a technical word of theology, and it means something that has been revealed to us about which we wouldn't know anything had it not been revealed. So in the Catholic faith, we have a number of mysteries. The primary one is the mystery of the Trinity itself. If our Lord hadn't told us that God is a Trinity, we wouldn't know, and we wouldn't be able to reason to it. In fact, the ancient Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, so on, were able, using reason alone, to prove a lot of things, such as God's existence and certain of his attributes, his omniscience, his omnipresence, his omnipotence, and so on. The one thing they could not reason to, and they never approached, was his Trinitarian nature. That was just not something that's open to human reason to conclude from otherwise known things. So right. The Trinity itself is a mystery. The incarnation is a mystery. And there, you know, the real presence of the Eucharist is a mystery. There are things that we would not know the truth of unless they had been revealed to us by God. Okay. Through Jesus telling us this and the church teaching us this. Now, some people, and Sheed alludes to them, think a mystery means something about which we don't know anything, but we just accept it on faith. That's not the case, because every time a mystery is revealed to us, we know something about that mystery. So our Lord revealed certain things to us about the Trinity. And as Sheed says, you can't prevent men from drawing true conclusions from true facts. So when we have certain facts about the Trinity, certain conclusions can be drawn from them. That doesn't mean we understand everything about the Trinity. We certainly don't. But mm-hmm. it's fair to say that Augustine, who wrote a treatise on the Trinity, knew a lot more about the Trinity than, say, Clement of Rome, who was the fourth pope at the end of the first century. And Aquinas, who lived so many centuries after Augustine, he knew more than Augustine did about the Trinity, because there were centuries of scholars and theologians thinking through what conclusions could be drawn from the facts that our Lord told us about the Trinity. Okay. So there's much that we can know, but of course there's much more that we don't know or can't know about any one of these mysteries, whether the real presence or the incarnation or the Trinity. So mystery isn't something that we know nothing about. It's something that we know something about because it's been revealed to us, and it's something that we can draw conclusions about, at least to a limited extent. And, you know, enough really to fill our own desires. So our Lord's revealed to us the truth of the mystery of the Trinity. It's something that we know, we will never know everything about. You know, we can know everything about the multiplication table, and we end up knowing all about that when we're children. there's nothing more to learn about it. And it's also can be said about certain other things in life. But these religious mysteries, there's a limit based on partly on what we've been told, but partly on our own capacities to absorb the information. But yet we can learn so much about it that the knowledge and appreciation of these mysteries ought to be key formatters of our lives, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, there's a development of doctrine that goes on there where, the understanding of the Trinity grows in the sense that I think it might have even been Sheed using the analogy of walking into a darkened room and you can make out the outline of the furniture and so on. And when you turn the lights up, it becomes clearer, although nothing changes in the room.
Yes. And interestingly, historically speaking, development, and this is something also that John Henry Newman wrote a lot about, development of doctrine, that doesn't mean change of doctrine, it means a doctrine deepening in our understanding of it. Development often comes about in the conflict between heresy and orthodoxy, where somebody will come up with what he thinks is a proper explication of some dogma, and yet he's wrong to some degree, and there's a squabble that goes on maybe over centuries. For example, in the earliest centuries, there was the Arian heresy, which taught that Christ had only one nature, the human, not the divine. That was an error. But it became a very powerful heresy because it attracted many people who found it hard to accept that Christ could have two natures, divine and human. They couldn't see how that mystery could happen, the incarnation. So they simplified things. And later on, there were other people who went the other way and said, no, he's got only a divine nature and not a human. So you've got these sort of paired off heresies, but precisely because that they came up, the church had to work out an explication of the true doctrine. And so it's been with the Trinity, because the Trinity over the centuries from many different angles has been attacked. Yes. And every attack has been an opportunity to clarify in the long run what the Trinity really is about.
Yes. So it's almost like, we could cross off the list that this particular heresy is an explanation, and so kind of getting rid of bad explanations, it kind of sheds light on what the proper explanation is.
That's right. I suppose you could be Hegelian about it and say, there's a thesis, there's an antithesis, and then a synthesis. There's a thesis is this is what the church teaches. The antithesis is a misunderstanding of it. And then when those two battle, so to speak, there's a more clarified explication of the church's position. So in a way, we benefited historically from people misunderstanding things, even though we wish they hadn't misunderstood. Nevertheless, the very fact that they did misunderstand led us to a deeper appreciation of what the facts really are.
Right, yeah. Well, let me throw an objection out at you. Someone could say, well, Carl, I'm a Catholic. I believe in the Trinity. I recite the creed, but I don't really need to understand it. I could be a good Catholic and go to heaven without really understanding all the intricacies. Why is it important for us to have a good grasp of the Trinity?
Well, if this is a man talking, I could say, you're married to your wife. You know her to some degree, but you don't need to know her pretty well to have a decent marriage. But don't you think that the better you know your wife, the better your marriage could be? The better you can understand her and appreciate her, the better marriage you'll have, both for her and for you. So the more we know God and about God, the more likely it is that our own lives as Christians will be improved, that we'll be more moved to do what we ought to be doing, moved to not do what we ought not to do. If God is simply a vague figure out there, doesn't get past the childish notion of a bearded guy sitting on a cloud, if that's as close as we have to an understanding of God, then he's not going to have much impact on our lives. If he doesn't have much impact on our lives are not going to be what they ought to be. So the more we understand, the better off. Now, as Sheed says right in this book, you don't have to be a scholar to be a saint. And I suppose one could probably argue that in many cases, trying to be a scholar works against one's sanctity, if not against one's sanity. Okay.
Right.
So you don't have to be a scholar to be a saint. You don't have to be well-read. You don't have to read anything. For centuries, Christians couldn't read at all. That's why, you know, the stained glass windows, such as in Notre Dame, which we saw, you know, so much in the news this week, those were made precisely as kinds of catechisms or history books for those who could not read. Mm. So you can be a saint without being literate. But if you're literate and you can learn by reading the good stuff and coming to understand it and improving your knowledge of God, doesn't that suggest that you'll be able to love him better and to serve him better?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's my thinking of it. And that's what Sheed, I think, was very, very good at explaining.
Yeah. Yeah. Very well put. In fact, about talking about reading, you know, learning more and loving God more, how can people get a hold of some of your works?
Well, they can go to carlkeating.com, where I mentioned many of them. But if they want to actually buy them, then they go to Amazon. And all you need to do is look up my name at Amazon, and you'll come to the author page, which lists all of my books in all of their editions.
Very good. Yeah, in fact, Carl, you know, I was on your site today. And by the way, folks, Carl not only writes incredibly good material on apologetics, but other things too. I went on your site, and I'm going to buy this book, even though I'm not sure I'm interested in the content, but the cover sold me, How to Fail at Hiking to the Grand Canyon. Folks, go to carlkeating.com. Check out the cover. This is an awesome book. I'm going to pick it up, I promise.
Okay, well, okay, I don't want to misrepresent to the audience. How to Fail at Hiking Grand Canyon is not out yet. I'm working on finishing it up. But How to Fail at Hiking Mount Whitney is available.
Okay.
And so these are two books in a four-book series called the How to Fail at Hiking series, where I use a basic principle that applies to religion also. We learn things two ways. One way is through positive instruction. Do this, follow these 10 steps, and so on.
Right.
But we learn equally well from observing our own and other people's mistakes. And if we learn what things lead to failure in any activity, whether it's hiking or theology, if we learn what leads to failure and then we learn to avoid those things, we're more likely to succeed.
Very good. Well, thank you, Carl, for coming on Hands-On Apologetics. We appreciate it.
Gary, it's been a wonderful time. I always enjoy being with you. Thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you. And that is Carl Keating, folks. Please check out his stuff. He's got great material, and he continues to put out great material. I recommend all his books. Just, you know, that should be on your bookshelf along with Frank Sheed's works and Ronald Knox and Ireland Lund and all the greats. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Dawn Eden Goldstein about her conversion to Catholicism from Judaism. It's going to be a fascinating discussion. And also Friday, Trent Horn joins us to talk about his brand new book, Counterfeit Christ. So it's going to be a great week. We're going to finish out strong for Holy Week. And thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Coming up next, high-intensity Catholic talk radio coming at you with the dynamic duo of Terry and Jesse. And, man, it just flew. This program just flies. It's the fastest hour of the day for me. Again, thanks for listening. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here and turn down the dojo lights. Coming up next, our Terry and Jesse show. I wish everybody a happy and holy day. God bless.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.